from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll chat with the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra's Kirk Trevor and Executive Director Elaine Eckert.
I'll get a preview of the upcoming Broadway Across America series coming to Indianapolis.
And WFYI's Scott Hoke, our morning guy, joins us for a special interview with the ISO's new CEO, Gary Gensling. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar of events we call
What Do We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. For its next concert, the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra is going silent. Sharon Gamble invited Maestro Kirk Trevor and Executive Director Elaine Eckert to our studios to find out why.
So it sounds like a contradiction in terms to say the ICO goes silent, but there's a reason for that clever title. Elaine, enlighten us.
Oh, okay, certainly. Well, the silent means silent film. And this concert features, we screen a silent film from 1920s era, and we have live orchestral accompaniment. This is a collaboration with the IMA and their film series.
Mm-hmm. And at the Tobias Theater, the Toby, as we regulars call it.
So I call it a larger-than-life experience because that film is the screen pretty much fills the stage, and the orchestra is on the floor in silhouette, but you have, you know, really heightened aural from the orchestra and visual from the movie.
Sure.
And this year's movie is called Show People. It's a 1928 film, and it's about a young, you know, actress who's going to Hollywood to make it big, and it's a very cute story.
And she's called Peggy Pepper when she heads out there, but by the time she has her image as an actress, she's Patricia Pepoir.
Yes,
so
yes.
Very elegant.
And she learns some hard lessons about fame and fortune. And that's I don't want to spoil the film, but
I hope she finds happiness in the end.
Yeah, of course. In 1928 they always found happiness.
That's right.
Isn't it the same today?
Yeah.
The same
I think that plot line describes an awful lot of Meg Ryan films or you know, name an actress from any era and it works the same way. So you've done a number of these. How many years is this?
This is
silent?
Fifth
year, I thought so. So some often these silent films had organ accompaniment instead of full orchestra accompaniment.
Well, back in the 20s, there were four levels of theaters in America. We call them A, B, C, D, I think is what they were. And Radio City Music Hall was an A theater, and the Fox in Atlanta and St. Louis were both A theaters. And part of that designation was how large the pit was, how many musicians, full-time musicians, were hired by the theater to play. And I think A orchestras had more than 36, or 36 was the general number for a large theater orchestra. And then the B orchestras or the B theaters had room for 22 and something like that, and it kind of went down 16 and 8. Obviously, the organist was a mainstay of many of the movies, but these small theater orchestras were really a part of growing up in the teens and the 1920s and 30s, certainly, of going to movies. It's having that theater orchestra playing, you know, while you were eating the popcorn as you came in and during the intermission and, of course, during the movie itself.
So they'd be essentially orchestras in residence playing that theater forever.
They were full-time employees of the theater. And we have done one. Last year we did one style of movie where we played what's called stock chart. In other words, instead of having a composer write through compose the music specifically for that movie, the musicians would get, you know, a romantic scene, you know, a stock type of style of music and a chase and the slapsticks moment. And these were pieced together, and they were just kind of played one after the other, and the conductor would just kind of call out 6B, and it would be that scene for whatever was happening on the screen.
Huh.
Now, for this movie, we're going to do what we have done four of the five times, which is play a contemporary score that has been composed specifically for this movie. So that means really there are two issues, of course, the largest one being how can the conductor synchronize the music
Absolutely.
With the movie.
Yeah.
When you in stock, you at least have some gaps where
you have some flexibility to expand
or
contract.
You can stop it any way you want.
Sure.
You can repeat it. But in a through-composed score like this, you have to either stick with the movie. So if you get behind, you have to start playing faster. If you get ahead, you have to start playing slower. And so that means that the conductor has to know the movie intimately to know exactly which bar synchronizes with what's going on the screen.
Sure.
So I have in my score lots of notes like, you know, she blinks a foot, he raises his finger, all kinds of things. Bird flies in from the left or whatever it is. Just things that you're trying to line up with certain beats in the bar so that you have to have enough of this so you can really stay on track. If you get behind in a car chase, and that happened we had a Howard Lloyd movie, which was Safety Last, and there was a very fast car chase in that. It lasted about 2 minutes, and the music was incredibly fast, incredibly difficult. And unfortunately, what happened is that in the 1920s, there was no uniform speed at which films were played.
Really?
They could be shot at 18 frames per second and then projected at 22. You know, we would hope that they had variable speed projectors.
Sure.
But in the Toby, we only had a 24 frame per second projector at the time. And the movie had been shot at 19 frames per second, which meant that we in the car chase, we were actually having to play it 30% faster than it was actually written already. And so this car chase in the rehearsal, we realized something was wrong here, you know, because it was becoming impossible to play. So we had to find ways to cut out a few bars and piece them together and then still play as fast as humanly possible. And if you get behind, you know, it just...
How do you catch up?
Yeah, because you can't suddenly, what happened? It goes into the love scene and we're still playing the car chase.
Right, that's not right. That's not what you want the audience to feel. So, of course, great musicians and a great conductor can make anything happen as long as they're watching each other and staying together. But do you have at least one rehearsal where the film is being screened while you're rehearsing?
Yeah, well, right from the beginning, we only have two rehearsals, and so we just put the movie on straight away.
Yeah.
But the key is that I spend, you know, from now until for the next 3 weeks, I just watch the movie once every night, you know, and I don't try to learn the music. I try to learn the movie.
Sure.
So that I can recognize exactly where I am in the movie. So I can look at a movie and say, I know exactly what's going to happen 2 seconds from now.
And that's not something they taught you in conducting school.
Certainly not, no. It's just a whole other world.
Hey, but you know what? Now with five of these on your resume, I think maybe you should be teaching a master class.
Silent movies,
joking.
It's definitely a fascinating art form in terms of conducting. And I talked to Maren Alsop, you know, who started doing it in Baltimore.
Right.
And she called me once, and we were talking, and she said, you know, how do you do this stuff? You know, and she was doing a Charlie Chaplin movie that I had done, and I said, you just have to, don't learn the score, learn the movie
first. Right. Crazy. And it's so interesting how in this very digital age, people are interested in old forms of entertainment again, which is awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, so we go from silent film accompaniment at the Toby to the newest house in town, not open as we're having this conversation, but it will be open. Actually, you're playing there on April 21st, and that's Schrott Hall at Butler University. You've had a rehearsal there?
We had a rehearsal back in March, and it was a tuning rehearsal.
Uh-huh.
I think it was kind of for us as much as for anybody else, of course, to see whether we could really view this as a potential home for us. I mean, obviously, we'd love to play in the new hall if it's going to be a wonderful place to make music. And obviously, we've been looking for years and years at all the potential venues in Indianapolis, and we're at the History Center, which we love, of course, but it is slightly on the small side, mm-hmm. certainly for us.
Stage-wise and house-wise.
Yes, right. We back in March we played the Schumann First Symphony, and we were absolutely as tight as could be on that. And
I was worried somebody was going to keel off the stage there. It was pretty packed.
Well, what was interesting was that the first rehearsal of that set was at the Schott in this tuning rehearsal, and the stage there is vast.
It's bigger than Clues, which Clues is like a football field.
Yeah, it's vast. So when we played there at the tuning rehearsal, we actually were, just a little pod in the middle of this huge lagoon, and but it was made clear to us afterward that the shell is variable. You know,
sure.
We could actually have a two-thirds version of that shell, which I think we would use for our performances in future. And then we went the next day from that to the History Center. So and suddenly, there was this kind of probably one-fifth the size of the Schott stage at the History Center, and it was just kind of interesting experience. Everybody was now elbow to elbow, and the whole closeness, the intimate part of the ICO.
Yeah,
I was just
going to say,
you read
my
mind.
It's a different, another meaning, another shade of the meaning
word.
Of intimate.
Yes,
classic,
I love my
original.
Stand mate. I have
yes,
to,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
Even though I get an elbow every time she plays the violin. Yes.
So you're going to be back. What's on the concert on the 21st of April?
We're going to play four iconic works of the American composer. The festival, of course, is a revolution.
Right.
That's the theme of the... And we're going to use the revolutionary part of it is the Rhapsody in Blue in the original jazz band version.
Ooh,
the Paul
fun.
Whiteman jazz band version. So, we grow up with Rhapsody in Blue in the orchestral version, and then once in a while somebody comes along and does it in the original, and it's a really eye-opening experience. We did it for the first time in February. In this version, and it was very, very revealing. There were quite a few differences, not in the piano part, although Spencer, who played it that time, was shocked at how different a feeling it was mm-hmm. with the jazz band version. So if you haven't heard it before, this is certainly something unique, rarely heard, I think, in its original version.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're doing the Barber Adagio, which is, as iconic as it comes. And then the Overture to West Side Story by Leonard Bernstein. And then we're going to do the Copland Clarinet Concerto with our principal clarinetist, Ellie Eman, playing the solo.
Beautiful.
So Copland, Barber, Bernstein, and Gershwin. For really speak to me for the change and a revolution in what became the American style, when we try to say what makes American music American, I think it would be those four composers.
Mm. And
just to backtrack just a little bit, this concert is on the first weekend of a two-week festival that is called the Butler Arts Fest.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that Butler, Jordan College of Arts, is kind of reviving. An annual arts fest, and they are doing it in conjunction with the opening of this hall. So we're on the first weekend. Our concert is Sunday, April 21st at 7 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
There will be concerts that weekend, Thursday through Sunday.
Something close to 40 events in that packed in
yes.
that two-week
yes.
period. So
exactly.
And this is envisioned to be an annual event, a little bit like Spoleto. Maybe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then the second weekend will be the following weekend mm-hmm. from whatever that is, the 26th to the 28th or 25th to the 28th, something like that. But yes, very exciting at Butler. And it's going to be a combination of productions by Butler students, Jordan College of Arts companies, as well as Indianapolis area arts groups such as the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra. Some are ticketed, which ours is a mm-hmm. ticketed event. Some are free. So there's a lot. And that's the Butler Arts Fest.
So stay tuned for contact information for both of those events.
Sharon Gamble with Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra Music Director Kirk Trevor and Executive Director Elaine Eckhart. The ICO will be at the Toby at the IMA on Friday, April 19th, to perform the accompaniment to the silent film Show People. You can also catch the ICO twice at the new Schrott Hall at Butler University during the inaugural Butler Arts Fest on April 21st and at its season finale on Saturday, May 18th. Get lots more information at icomusic.org. Again, icomusic.org.
Springtime, fresh air, flowers blooming, and all things considered, there's no time like the here and now to show your support of WFYI. It's Silent Web Week, and there are no limits to the stolen moments WFYI offers you each day in This American Life. Tell me more, you ask? Well, here's the backstory. Now through April 14th, make a snap judgment on being a WFYI supporter, or shall we say, a part of our radio lab, and you'll automatically be entered to win an Apple iPad Mini. Do you know how much these go for in the marketplace? Wait, don't tell me. No pipe dreams here, folks. This is for real. Go to WFYI.org and make your pledge now for a chance to win an iPad Mini. Pledges are encouraged, but not required. Boy, I sure have a way with words.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. The 2013-2014 Broadway Across America series coming to Indianapolis features some great musicals based on hit movies and TV shows, but what most people are already getting excited about is that the Book of Mormon is coming to town. Travis DiNicola spoke with Leslie Brooker, president of Broadway in Indianapolis, to find out more.
Leslie, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Always great to chat with you.
Oh, likewise. We're so thrilled about our new season.
I bet you are. I mean, okay, as we're recording this, you know, I'm hearing stories about how Book of Mormon has broken every record in the world for the way it just sold out in England, right?
Oh,
on the London stage? I mean, that's just amazing.
There, 2 weeks ago, it went on sale in Washington and mm-hmm. crashed the Kennedy Center's website and all their phones. So, I mean, with it comes many blessings, but also it's a little bit crazy. It's a wonderful show, though.
That's so cool. And that, of course, is the anchor of the 2013-2014 series Broadway in Indianapolis. Now, Book of Mormon is not coming to Indy until June 17th. And there are a lot of other cool shows that I want to talk about. So we'll hold off on Book of Mormon for just a second.
All right.
But you kick off your season this year with, actually the first two shows are based on great movies from the 80s, right? Flashdance and Ghost.
I think people are going to be really excited to see these because they'll flash back to those memories. And both of these shows, starting with Flashdance, I think bring through all of the wonderful things that people remember from the movie. And, of course, Flashdance, the music and the steaminess and you know, Alex the steel mill welder, everybody remembers.
Oh, yeah. Now, is there a scene where she dumps the water on top of herself in the musical? Do you know?
You know that has to bring down the first act.
It's got
it?
To, right? Right? Okay.
I mean, if we didn't have that in there, and this is a pre-Broadway tour, so we're getting it very early on, and are very excited about it.
Oh,
yes,
cool.
We do. We do it right at the end of the first act because there's a lot of mopping up that needs to be done before we can get on to act two.
Kind of reminds me of when they did the Broadway version of Singing in the Rain about maybe 20 years ago, and it was
yep.
a big deal. But I remember all the stages that held it used to talk about how they had to clean it up after that first act. So okay.
That's right.
Well, cool. So that'll be fun. And that's unusual for you guys, isn't it, that you're having this pre-Broadway for Flashdance?
Well, I think because Indianapolis is really supporting our series, and when I'm looking at what shows we can book, mm-hmm. Being able to get a pre-Broadway I think is so important just because it's fun to see a musical in progress. We've done it in some other cities, and they've seen it very early on, even the second week of the tour. So hopefully what happens is, you know, we will contribute to molding and shaping the show for when it goes to Broadway, and we can take a little bit of credit for helping.
That's pretty cool. That's very exciting. That's excellent. And so that one is in October, and then the season really jumps to the spring of 2014, where you've got a whole bunch of great shows just sort of back-to-back almost.
That's correct.
Okay, so March 4th is when Ghost the Musical is coming here. Tell me a bit about that.
Ghost was on Broadway last season, won some awards. It's very neat, and much like Flashdance, it does retain some of the what I would call the iconic scenes from the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you do have, the first thing I'm ever asked is the pottery wheel scene in there?
Right.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It's very steamy, but they also work in a whole lot of high-tech video screens and walls, if you will, so that it can simulate a lot of the motion of the movie, because the movie takes place in a number of different places. Oda Maze, when they go to Oda Maze, we're able to go there. And all of those characters that bring so much life to the movie are there along with the passion and great, wonderful music.
Cool. That's going to be a lot of fun, I would imagine.
I really enjoyed it. I saw it on Broadway and thoroughly enjoyed it. It did quite well. So we're glad to get it in its first year of its tour.
Now, the one after that in April of 2014, and this one's going to be at Clues Hall, is Memphis. And when I first heard about this musical, I was kind of thinking, you know, is it going to be more of a musical review? But it's actually, it sounds like if you like Jersey Boys, you'll probably like this show. In fact, I know some of the creative team behind Jersey Boys had some input with Memphis too, right?
That's right. Well, in addition, and then you toss in David Bryan from Bon Jovi. So, I mean, you've got this
stellar
all-star team. But, you know, someone said to me the other day, Memphis, which won the Best Musical Prize for 2010, Memphis is what you want in a brand-new Broadway show. It's got fabulous dancing. It's got, Forbidden Love. It has fabulous music, obviously, with this creative team. But it's very passionate, and it's about the blues kind of coming of age and becoming more mainstream from having, you know, basically been played in basements and hidden away. It's the mainstreaming of it coming to radio, and it's spectacular, which I suppose is why it won the 2010 Tony.
Yeah. Now, okay. So Bon Jovi's David Bryan, wrote the score and music for it, but it's original music, but based on that Memphis sound from the 50s. Is that right?
That's correct. I mean, it's from the dance clubs that were essentially underground at the time, and it was all this sizzling music, and you can even see that in some other shows like the Million Dollar Quartet, where that sound is beginning to infiltrate everyday music.
Sure.
But it's you know, people are a little wary of it, much like rock and roll, mm-hmm. later in the 60s, 70s. So it brings that out, and it's just... It's just a very passionate musical, but it follows a traditional book musical, if you will, and that's where the Jersey Boys guys came in, because they created the book and lyrics for that.
Sounds like you're a fan.
I am absolutely a fan. It's a wonderful show.
Cool. And then you follow that up with The Addams Family, which is just a great musical comedy, of course, based on the Addams Family TV show and all that. I mean, that should be a lot of fun, right?
Well, and when you know, everybody immediately, you know, they're creepy and they're kooky, mysterious.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, every bit of that does come into it and is just so much fun. It'll be a great show for families and a lot of surprises. A couple of puppets are in this show to recreate some of the characters that people could probably guess.
Mm-hmm.
And it's absolutely spectacular. Jerry Zaks directs it. And, you know, he's very well known on Broadway, and it's a first-class show, so it's really going to be terrific.
Well, of course, it's got to be classy with Gomez and Morticia. I mean, what else would you expect?
Exactly. Cousin It, it's just silly fun, and we're pleased. It was on Broadway 2 years ago and mm-hmm. did very well. Brooke Shields was in it. Nathan Lane was in it. We're excited about the cast that we have. They're not a named cast, but it's a very high-quality production that we're very pleased is going to play there.
Well, and all of these shows, as you said, I mean, you get some really, really talented professional actors, dancers, musicians, singers that are part of these shows for the Broadway series.
Correct. I mean, these are shows that are mounted and cast in New York and tour across the country. Our mm-hmm. task is, you know, the jigsaw puzzle of when is the theater available and what show. And, of course, I'm always trying to put together a season that reaches across a lot of different people's interests. Some people want to bring their kids to a show. Some people want date nights. Some people, you know, want to be challenged and, you know, really heady. And so we look for that nice, broad if you will, collection of shows that put together, you know, is able to address all of those different needs that people have when they want to go to the theater.
So let's talk about the Book of Mormon, which is the last show of the five-show season series. This show is just, I mean, breaking every record, as we said at the beginning of this interview. What makes it so good? I have you had a chance to see it?
Oh, yes.
Of course, you have.
I've seen it twice. I'm a Tony voter, so I go up to New York. I mean, it's one of the wonderful things about the job is that I do go up and preview all the shows before we book them. And Book of Mormon is not the family show on the season.
No.
As folks know, it's from the creators of South Park, and a gentleman that was, involved with Avenue Q. And I think what has made this show so special is the fact that they're such smart writers. The music is hummable, and it takes you to places that are scary, that are offensive, that are things that we wouldn't normally say. But then when you circle back and they tie it all up in a nice, neat bow, you get why they made you feel uncomfortable in the theater. I mean, I think that's what an author wants to take a viewer on a journey, and they take you to places that are unexpected and then circle you back, and that's what this show does.
Well, and Avenue Q certainly did that in some ways as well.
Certainly. I mean, it doesn't have quite Avenue Q was a bit more playful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, South Park is playful. Not South Park. The Book of Mormon is playful, but it definitely has language, you know,
okay,
in it that people need to be informed. It's a show where we feel an obligation, certainly we want it in the market because it's the hottest show, but we also have an obligation to inform people that it does have elements of it that some people may, in fact, find offensive, but we always believe you should know before you go.
Sure, absolutely. And then I do want to mention that one other show that you guys are bringing back is Wicked, a hugely popular show, a great show, and that's going to be in November through the very beginning of December, so a great sort of, you know, pre-holiday thing, but that's not part of the regular season, right?
That's correct. When we've put a show on season and our subscribers who stick with us, we don't want to put a show in a package that they would have to see over and over, so we make it as an option,
mm-hmm,
and they certainly have the choice to purchase it, but we don't put it as a part of the package so that if, in fact, they've seen it 80 times and they don't want to see it the 81st, then they're covered.
Sure, but a popular show like that, of course, so many people want to see that again or haven't had a chance to see it yet. So that's cool that you're bringing Wicked back. Such a great
Absolutely.
Show.
Absolutely. We hear it's a show that will live on, and it's got so much good messaging in it, and we hear certainly from our subscribers as well as the community how much they enjoy having that show, and it's, you know, like you said, great timing coming in right before the holidays.
Well, let me ask you this, because a friend of mine the other day, when he had heard that Book of Mormon was coming, he's like, well, when can I buy my, you know, individual tickets? And I want to make sure I'm right about this. You can't get them yet. You have to, season tickets are available, and that's the best way to do this, but individual tickets for individual shows don't go on sale until usually about a month or 2 months before each show comes to town. Is that about right?
That's correct. We have not set the date for single ticket sales. Typically, it is 6 to 8 weeks prior to the show.
Okay.
Because of the popularity of this show, it may go a little bit earlier, but we will announce those dates. But as you said before, the best way to guarantee it and to not be standing in line or waiting on the phone or trying to get it through the computer is absolutely to order season tickets, which for all five shows, our season is as low as $141. So we think it's accessible.
Yeah.
You know, for everyone. And once you have a single, you know, one season ticket, then you have access to as many tickets for the other shows as you need and Edward.
Oh, okay. That's very cool. And then and you can also, I know you have a lot of different, you know, flexible ticket packages and upgrade stuff and things like that available for season ticket holders as well.
Exactly. We have some folks, you know, if you subscribe on a Wednesday and something comes up, you can easily exchange, you know, to another day of the performance. And we have great folks at our office downtown who can take care of that. And it really is an easy way to do it. And I think people are usually quite pleased once they've made that decision.
Cool. Well, and what a great variety of shows this year. I mean, all of them just sound like winners. Always very fun. I know you personally really enjoy curating the shows that that are part of each season. So thanks for doing that.
Well, it's, you know, I'm so lucky to work in a business that I love. I still get goosebumps when I go to the theater, and I'm still very excited as New York starts to generate new shows, and we've got Tony Awards coming up, and the new Broadway season has just started, so we're off and running for the 14-15 season.
Awesome. Great. Leslie, thank you so much for chatting today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Travis DiNicola with Leslie Brooker, president of Broadway in Indianapolis. To find out more about the series and to buy season tickets, visit indianapolis.broadway.com. Again, indianapolis.broadway.com.
Hey, Sharon.
Yes, Travis.
You know what anniversary is coming up this weekend?
I don't. Oh, no?
The 101st anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic.
My heart will go on. So it is April 14th.
Yeah, well, there you go. So
that's disturbing that I'm using brain cells to remember that date.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very good.
So I'm guessing that you have something arts related.
Nope, nothing at all.
Oh,
there's
okay.
Nothing at all. Just thinking, okay. You know, if you wanted to go out and celebrate the anniversary of the sinking Titanic, we will give you some ideas on that calendar we call.
What will we do?
Really? I don't know. Sure, why not? Think of it as a Titanic weekend. Here's a great event to go to. Talk about a segment.
I so wish I had a rearranging deck chairs item.
There you go. This is actually coming up next weekend. Modus Dance is having their next concert. I love the title. It's called Ruckus. One night of artistry, eye-popping performance, and banging bands. Raise a ruckus. It's going to be April 20th, 9 p.m. at the White Rabbit Cabaret down in Fountain Square, including These City Limits, Cultural Cannibals, The Rocket Doll Review, Minimum Memory, Eclectic Pond, No Exit, and Modus, of course. I don't know if that one I pronounced correctly, but that's fine. But Modus is just great fun. They do great dance pieces with a lot of other fun things thrown in. Check them out April 20th at White Rabbit Cabaret.
The eye popping part gives me pause. I kind of like my eyes in my head.
Pop your eyes, sure.
Actually, you might want. I do have something Titanic related. This is such a segue. This is such a stretch. The Indiana Historical Society maintains a genealogy research library at the Indiana History Center. There are people in the Sound of Our Voices who have ancestors of friends who were aboard the Titanic. So maybe you want to go to the Indiana History Center,
well,
check out some of the You Are There exhibits. That's right. And there you go.
Well, okay. Hey. A game that was popular during the time of the Titanic sinking, of course, is croquet. And this year is, are you ready for this? The 19th annual Wicket World of Croquet Tournament is taking place at the President Benjamin Harrison Home. And the event this year is on Saturday, June 1st. Why am I talking about it now? Because there's lots of great fun events in preparation for this year's event. This year's event also, in addition to the regular competitive bracket, has more of a leisure bracket. There's very fun.
That's code for beer drinkers, right?
Well, Sun King may be involved
okay.
with this, yes. It is a lot of fun, and be on the lookout for some pop-up croquet tournaments between now and June 1st. But you can register your team to participate in the Wicket World of Croquet on June 1st if you go to the Benjamin Harrison Presidential website at bhpsite.org.
There will be a summer if we're talking about Wicket World of Croquet already.
Yes.
Okay. On April 20th at 8 o'clock at the Garfield Park Arts Center, you can see another in the series. This is a series program by Eric Grayson, who's having kind of a dark winter and spring, I think, because these are all mystery or murder films. This April 20th Saturday night film is Bowery at Midnight, a 1942 movie starring Bela Lugosi. By day, he's a psychology professor, but at night, he runs a Bowery soup kitchen where the down and out tend to disappear, but they reappear as zombies.
Zombies.
So,
of course they do.
Bowery at Midnight, Bela Lugosi, be there or be square. $4 admission at the door, concessions available. More information at gpacarts.org. That's short for Garfield Park Arts Center. So gpacarts.org.
Well, something else that could both be creepy or cute. I think I just invented a new word.
Cupy. I like
Cupy. And this is actually, it's a ballet called Cipollino. And the story is, it's based on an Italian children's story in which Cipollino, who's a little onion, he fights the unjust treatment of his fellow vegetable town folk by the fruit royalty. That's right. Prince Lemon and Lord Tomato are quite mean to the other vegetables in that garden kingdom. And so little Cipollino, the little onion, must fight back. And There are no zombies in this, but it is a really
Weren't
sweet
you
ballet.
Involved with a production of this, some walk-on part a couple years ago?
No, not with Cipollino. No. Okay. I'd love to. It sounds great. I'm sure they can make me a tomato or something.
Tomato.
You say tomato. But anyway, this is it's being produced by the Indiana Ballet Conservatory, and it's their spring production taking place on May 4th and 5th at the Toby at the IMA.
From Dancing Vegetables to Johann Sebastian Bach.
There we go.
The Magnificat and the Lauridsen Lux Aeterna. The Indianapolis Symphonic Choir will be performing with the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra on Friday, April 12th. That's this Friday at Clues Hall at 8 p.m. If you're hearing us on Saturday morning, I hope you enjoyed it.
Hey, the Athenaeum has a ton of cool events coming up during the rest of the month, including a Birth of Soul concert on April 12th and 19th in the theater, performance called Let Go, Let God, that's on April 13th. There's also a piece called Science on Tap, that sounds interesting to me, April 17th, and a whole lot more, including some children's performances and the St. Benno Festival, all taking place at the Athenaeum. Log on to the Athenaeum Foundation.org site to get their full schedule of all the cool work that they're doing, including a People for Urban Progress art exhibit that they have up in their art space area.
If you have been on Monument Circle in the last day or so, you might have noticed those 8 sculptures that were created by artists from pianos. It's called Piano Parts, this exhibition, and the display is up to publicize the American Pianists Association Classical Fellows Discovery Week and finals coming up throughout the middle and end of this month. Those piano sculptures, if you see one you're really attracted to, they are up for auction. They're up for auction.
Wow, so just talk to the organ grinder then.
No, but you want to go to American Pianist Association website and find out more about that, as well as, of course, the piano sculptures are groovy cool, but the whole idea is to go hear the young pianists and enjoy their artistry.
Excellent, excellent. That sounds like a great key to enjoying what they do. Okay, so at the Indie Fringe, lots of stuff going on through the rest of April, including a production of the Vagina Monologues going on this weekend. Also part of their spring film series with Indie Film Fest, Eating Alabama. They've got some concerts going on. It just goes on and on and on each and every month. But what I'm really excited about coming up in May, Sharon, our own Matt Sosie and family are going to be performing in the Going, Going, Gone monthly production.
I've been talking about that.
Yes, it's
so
true.
Fun.
Yeah, once a month, John Thomas and Lou Harry do this sort of a theatrical auction called Going, Going, Gone. They do it on the first Sunday night. And so in Sunday, Matt Sosie and family will be a part of it.
And Emma is, let's see, she is
runs
about,
the family.
She runs the family, yeah. She is 12, I think, or pretty darn close. Here's a way to celebrate getting your taxes done. On Monday, April 15th at 7:30, a free concert is the season finale for the Faculty Artist Series at the University of Indianapolis. So some of the best musicians in town, you see them on stage at the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra, and as they say, many, many more places. And they're doing works ranging from Mark Mellitz, a contemporary, in fact, under 50 composer, all the way to some more traditional works, including Mendelssohn's D minor piano trio. So check that out at the University of Indianapolis website, or just show up on Monday night, 7:30 at the DeHaan Fine Arts Center, April 15th. Happy Tax Day.
Speaking of taxes, Sharon, we have run out of time. We got to get those taxes done, so we'll be back next week on
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
For today's show, we have a special guest interviewer, but a voice you are certainly familiar with. Scott Hoke, who hosts Morning Edition here on WFYI, joins us with a conversation he recently recorded with Gary Gensling, the new CEO of the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra.
I'm curious to find out what attracted you to the Indianapolis Symphony. Of course, this orchestra has been through a lot here in the last couple of years with a long contract negotiation and an orchestral lockout. What attracted you to come to this city and lead this symphony now?
It all starts with the people for me, Scott, and it really starts with the music director, Krzysztof Urbanski, who I think is exceptionally talented, and I'm looking forward to working with him. And on down to the members of the board and the musicians who I met with and the members of the staff. Everyone was so enthusiastic and optimistic about the future and felt like a group of people I was really excited to be with.
What do you hope to do early on? What is one thing that you really want to set in motion as soon as possible when you get here to Indianapolis?
Well, first and foremost, I'm really looking forward to getting to know the community and getting to know the people in the arts community and the constituents of the organization and really doing a lot of listening and then starting very quickly to build a vision for the future that everyone can feel excited about. And I think the community spoke loud and clear during the most recent fundraising campaign about how important this orchestra is to Indianapolis. And I look forward to getting to know all corners of the community and working together on building a bright future for the organization.
Obviously, the Cleveland Orchestra is very, very well known around the world and really is a pillar in the arts community in Cleveland. From the outside looking into Indy, where do you see the Indianapolis Symphony in its role in the community here, in the arts community here?
It's very interesting, Scott. I think that every orchestra has a role to play in its community. Whether you're an orchestra that's known internationally or you're a small community orchestra, I think these days orchestras are really asking themselves what is their role in a particular community. And I think what really struck me about the Indianapolis Symphony and the community was how the great history that this orchestra has, the fantastic artistic pedigree it has, the commitment of its musicians, the commitment of its staff and its trustees, and of course the support and commitment of the community, who spoke so loudly and clearly over the past few months, and that to me tells me that there's a role for this organization to play as an indispensable leader in the arts community in Indianapolis.
I think one of the things that you are known for and have been known for in Cleveland was really doing a lot to diversify the programming up there with the orchestra. Tell me a little bit about what you were able to do there and what you want to do in terms of doing the same thing here in Indy.
In Cleveland, we've really looked at new ways to develop programs that will allow us to reach more and more diversified segments of our community here in Northeast Ohio. And so we've put in place a number of series. We've introduced a series of celebrity concerts, pop concerts that the Cleveland Orchestra had historically never done during its winter season. We put in place new concert formats. We now do shorter one-hour concerts on Friday nights with world music and jazz in the lobby after concerts in order to try to attract a different kind of demographic. We've started doing fully staged opera during our seasons to reach into folks who appreciate opera but might not enjoy orchestral concerts. We've diversified with working with ballet companies like the Joffrey Ballet, and we've really tried to sort of ask ourselves, what can we do? We have this great asset, and how can we use it in new ways to get more people to appreciate it and get more people to come into our concert hall, and at the same time preserve what it is that we do best, which is give great orchestral concerts. Mm-hmm. And I think those are the same questions that Indianapolis can and must ask in the future. And it's too early for me to know what the answers might be, but I think when you have such a fantastic orchestra at your disposal, the question is how can you use it in new and creative ways while at the same time focusing on what you do best, which is giving great concerts.
Here in Indianapolis, of course, the orchestra calls the Hilbert Circle Theater home, and we have Symphony on the Prairie every summer. Happy hour concerts are fairly new. The Metropolitan Youth Orchestra side-by-side programs have been going on for quite a while with some of the young players here in Indianapolis. Do you see an area that you would like to address in terms of adding something else? For example, the opera series concerts that you were talking about, adding something to that mix that already exists here.
I think the Indianapolis Symphony has done a terrific job at creating new programs. You mentioned the Happy Hour series, the collaboration with Time for Three, the new collaboration they just announced with New Amsterdam. And I think the organization is well on its way to asking these kinds of questions. And so I look forward to joining that conversation. And what, you know, something specific like opera, to me, it does feel too soon to know if that's the right way to go. Look, it's an expensive art form, and there are a lot of different ways to diversify your programming. I look forward to sort of beginning the process with the group.
You mentioned Krzysztof Urbanski, and you mentioned Time for Three, a fantastic group of musicians. All of those guys are pretty young. The Happy Hour concerts are aimed very much at attracting a younger audience. How do you see working with the youth of this orchestra in perhaps trying to bring in a little bit younger audience and expand that demographic?
There are so many great assets that belong to the Indianapolis Symphony. Krzysztof, as you mentioned, and Time for Three, and the members of the orchestra. And I think for sure that bringing in younger demographics is certainly going to be a focus of ours. But I like to remind everybody that's not the only goal. And from where I sit, just getting more people to come is actually the first goal. Whether it's young or middle-aged or old, I want to see more people coming and appreciating this great asset of Indianapolis.
I want to talk a little bit about your background, both in the business world and the music world. You started off, actually, it may have been your first job, but you worked for a while in Silicon Valley. Tell me what you were doing there.
I did. I received a Master of Business Administration degree from UCLA and spent about 3 years in Silicon Valley with Sun Microsystems, where I was a product marketing manager and worked on some of the early generations of smartphone technology. Wow. for playing music and putting together business plans and marketing those to cell phone manufacturers and carriers.
They did not have a Sun Microsystems Symphony Orchestra back then, did they?
They did not. I tried, but I was unsuccessful at getting one started.
Well, and I mentioned that the potential of playing in an orchestra, you actually have your degree in music from, actually a couple of degrees from Yale and the Juilliard School. And I'm curious how the MBA and the work as a professional musician has really helped you in leading the Cleveland Orchestra. Before that, you were with the Berkeley Symphony, and you've been with the San Francisco Symphony. How has that helped your career with that diverse background?
I did spend a number of years playing professionally as a professional musician. I'm a clarinetist, and I'd like to think that helps me understand the perspective of the incredibly talented members of the orchestra and what they do day in and day out on stage, and really appreciate it in a way that just causes me to want to share it with more people. I understand how spectacularly talented they are. Each and every member of the orchestra has put in countless hours of preparing and practicing, and my hope is that it gives me a perspective that allows me to share my genuine enthusiasm and excitement for a live symphony orchestra. I just think there are a few things like hearing a great live orchestra, and my hope and my goal is to persuade as many people about that as possible.
I mentioned the San Francisco Symphony, and for those in the know in the classical music world, they'll know that Michael Tilson Thomas has been involved with that orchestra for a long time. And I'm just curious about your relationship with him. I know you've been quoted as saying he was the most important musical figure in my life. Tell me about working with MTT and how that's kind of helped you to become the general manager, to become the person that you are with regard to the orchestra.
Sure. I got to know Michael first, actually, by when I was a member of the New World Symphony, which was an orchestra that he founded in Miami, a training orchestra for young musicians. And I spent 4 seasons there with him and got to know him, and then had the great privilege of having a chance to work with him again at the San Francisco Symphony, where I spent 2 years as director of communications there. And as I said, he really was somebody who really had a major influence on my life musically, and also just from the standpoint of sort of being completely committed to what it is that you're doing and dedicated and giving it your all and not taking no for an answer in a way. Mm-hmm. And that's something that has really stuck with me, I think, as I've made the transition from being a player into the management side.
One more thing, and back to the music for just a second. Obviously, we all know there are so many musical genres that are out there. How do you look at your role with the ISO in making sure that we keep classical music as a significant part of that musical pie, if you will, if you slice that up in various genres? How do we keep classical music pertinent and a viable concert opportunity for folks today?
I think the Indianapolis Symphony has a huge role to play in that, and I certainly believe that the future vision for this orchestra involves being a real advocate for classical music and the arts in our community. And I think a professional orchestra can do that in ways that few other organizations can. I think, as I said, it all comes down to the experience of live music and hearing an orchestra live in the concert hall. I just think there are a few things in life that are as exciting and as vibrant and immediate as that, and I think an orchestra has a huge role to play in a community advocating for the arts, advocating for live music and for symphonic music.
WFYI's Scott Hoke with Gary Gensley and the new CEO of the ISO. For more information about the ISO, visit IndianapolisSymphony.org. Again, IndianapolisSymphony.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I talk with Ken Tershey about his new book about the history of the L.S. Ayers Company.
I'll find out about the work being done by the group We Are City.
And I'll get a preview of this year's Stutz Artist Spring Open House. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar we call What'll We Do?
Please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.